It'll have to be next time. It's nothing that urgent. I looked at his face again as we were about to get up. Why are you being so open with me? I asked, showing me the skeletons in your family's closet. He spread his hands on the table and thought for a minute. He scratched his ear. Let's see. For one thing, I'm getting a little tired carrying these family skeletons around all by myself. Maybe I wanted to share them with someone. Someone who has nothing to gain from them and who'll keep his mouth shut. In that sense, you're an ideal person to unburden myself to. Also, to tell the truth, I'm feeling a little guilty where you're concerned, so this may be my way of trying to pay you back. Guilty? I burst out. In what way? Masahiko half closed his eyes. I'd intended to tell you about that, he said, but there's no more time today. My next appointment is one I can't miss. Let's meet again soon. Then we can talk all we want. Masahiko paid the tab. Don't worry, he said. This much I can write off. I accepted with gratitude. After that, I drove the Corolla station wagon back to Odawara. By the time I parked the dusty old heap in front of the house, the sun had almost reached the ridge of the western mountains. A large flock of cawing crows was winging across the valley, heading to their nests. Chapter 38. He could never be a dolphin. By the time Sunday rolled around, I had a pretty good idea how to attack the canvas I'd set aside for Maria Akikawa's portrait. I still wasn't sure exactly what form the painting would take, but I did know how I should begin. Those first steps, which brush to use, what color, the direction of the first stroke, had come to me out of nowhere. They had gained a foothold in my mind and, bit by bit, taken on a tangible reality of their own. I loved this process. It was a chilly morning, the kind of morning that heralds the coming of winter. I brewed coffee, ate a simple breakfast, went to the studio, laid out what I needed to paint, and then stood before my easel, which held the empty canvas. In front of the canvas, however, sat my sketchbook, opened to the detailed pencil drawing I had done of the pit in the woods. I had tossed it off several mornings earlier without giving it much thought. I had even forgotten I had drawn it. Nevertheless, the longer I stood there facing the drawing, the more it sucked me in. The mysterious stone chamber in the woods, the secret opening, the sodden earth, the patchwork of fallen leaves, the sunlight filtering through the branches. As my imagination filled in the penciled sketch, I began to see it as a colorful painting. I could breathe in the air of the place, smell the grass, hear the birds singing. The pit I had drawn with such precision in my big sketchbook was beckoning me, luring me towards something, or was it somewhere? The pit was demanding that I paint it. I seldom thought of painting landscapes. I mean, I'd done virtually nothing but portraits for nearly 10 years. But maybe a landscape painting wasn't such a bad idea. The pit in the woods. This pencil sketch could be a first step in that direction. I removed my sketchbook and closed it. The unblemished white canvas remained on the easel, the canvas that would soon be graced by my portrait of Maria. At a few minutes before 10, as before, the blue Toyota Prius rolled silently up the slope. The doors opened, and Maria and her aunt Shoko stepped out. Shoko Akikawa was wearing a long, dark gray herringbone jacket, a light gray wool skirt, and patterned black stockings. Wrapped around her neck was a bright Missoni scarf, a chic late fall outfit. Maria was dressed much like before, a baggy varsity jacket, a windbreaker, jeans with holes in them, and dark blue Converse sneakers. Her head was bare. The air was chilly, and a thin blanket of clouds covered the sky. After a simple exchange of greetings, Shoko curled up on the sofa and, once again, immersed herself in her thick paperback. Maria and I left her there and went into the studio. I sat on the same wooden stool, Maria on the same simple straight-backed chair. 6 feet or so separated us. Maria took off her jacket, folded it, and laid it next to her chair. Then she removed her windbreaker. Underneath was a blue short-sleeved t-shirt and, beneath that, a gray long-sleeved t-shirt. Her chest was as flat as ever. She ran her fingers through her straight black hair. "Aren't you cold?" I asked. There was an old-fashioned kerosene space heater in the studio, but it was unlit. Maria gave a slight shake of her head, as if to say, "No, not particularly." "I'll start painting today," I said. "You don't have to do anything. It's enough if you just sit there. You can leave the rest to me."
"I can't not do anything," she said, looking me straight in the eye.
"What does that mean?" I asked, my hands on my knees.
"Like I'm living and breathing and thinking all kinds of stuff."
"Of course," I said. "Please breathe as much as you want and think as many thoughts as you can. All I meant was there's nothing special you have to do. I just want you to be yourself."
Yet Maria continued to stare straight at me, as if my explanation was too simple to swallow. "But I want to do something," she said.
"Like what?"
"I want to help you paint."
"I appreciate that, but what do you mean exactly? Help me in what way?"
"Mentally, of course."
"I see," I said, yet I couldn't think of anything specific she could do mentally to help.
"I'd like to see things as you see them," she said. "Look at myself through your eyes while you're painting me. I think I'd understand myself better if I did that, and you'd probably understand me better too."
"I'd love that," I said.
"Really?"
"Yes, really."
"It might get pretty scary sometimes."
"Knowing more about yourself, you mean?" Maria nodded.
"If you want to know yourself better, you have to bring in something different from someplace else."
"Are you saying you can't know yourself unless you add a third-person perspective?"
"A third-person perspective?"
"In other words," I explained, "to understand the relationship between A and B, you might need C, a third point of view. What we call triangulation."
Maria thought for a moment. "Maybe," she said with a shrug.
"Are you saying that what you bring in might be scary depending on the situation?"
Maria nodded.
"Have you had that scary feeling before?"
Maria didn't respond.
"If I can draw you the right way, maybe you'll be able to see yourself through my eyes," I said. "If all goes well, of course."
"That's why we need pictures."
"You're right, that's why we need pictures. Or literature, or music, or anything of that sort."
"If all goes well," I said to myself.
"So let's get started," I said to Maria. Looking at her face, I started mixing the brown for the underdrawing. Then I selected the first brush I would use on the painting. The work progressed slowly but smoothly. The painting would show her from the waist up. She was a beautiful girl, but beauty wasn't what I was after. Instead, I had to find what was hidden beneath the surface. What underlay her personality? What allowed it to subsist? I had to find that something and bring it to the canvas. It didn't have to be pretty. Sometimes it might even be ugly. In either case, though, I had to know her well enough to discover what that something was. Not through words or logic, but as a singular form, a composite of light and shadow. I concentrated on layering lines and color on the canvas, rapidly at times, at other times with painstaking care. Maria sat, unmoving, on the straight-backed chair, her expression never wavering. She had mustered her willpower, I sensed, and was sustaining it for as long as necessary. I could feel her strength. "I can't not do anything," she had said.
and indeed, she was doing something. To help me, most likely. An unmistakable current of some kind was flowing between this 13-year-old girl and myself. I recalled my sister's hand. She had taken my hand in hers when we entered the chilly darkness of the wind cave on Mount Fuji. Her hand was small and warm, yet her fingers were surprisingly strong. A definite life force connected us. Each was giving something to the other, and at the same moment, receiving something. It was an exchange limited to a particular time and place. It was bound to fade and disappear, but the memory remained. Memory can give warmth to time, and art can, when it goes well, give shape to that memory, even fix it in history, much as Van Gogh inscribed the figure of a country mailman on our collective memory so well that he lives on, even today. For the next 2 hours, we focused on our respective jobs without exchanging a word. Thinning the paint with linseed oil, I began by roughing in her form in a single color. That would be the portrait's underdrawing. Maria sat quietly in the chair, continuing to be herself. At noon, as they did every day, chimes rang in the distance, announcing that our time was up. I put down my palette and paintbrush, straightened my back, and stretched. Only then did I realize how tired I was. I took a deep breath to break my concentration, whereupon Maria finally let her body relax. The monochrome outline of Maria's head and shoulders was there on the canvas before me. This was the structure upon which the portrait would be built. It was skeletal, but at its core was the source of the heat that made her who she was. That was still hidden, but if I could grasp its general location, I would be able to make adjustments further down the line. Then all that would be left was fleshing out the skeleton. Maria didn't ask anything about what I had painted, nor did she ask to see it. I said little on my part as well. I was just too worn out. We left the studio together and moved to the living room without a word. Shoko was still absorbed in her paperback. She marked her spot, closed the book, removed her black-rimmed reading glasses, and looked up at us. I could see that she was a bit alarmed. Our fatigue must have been written on our faces. "Did it go all right?" she asked in a slightly worried tone. "We're only partway through the process, but we're right on schedule." "That's so good to hear," she said. "Would you mind if I made some nice hot tea? I've already set the water to boil, and I know where you keep the tea leaves." Taken somewhat aback, I glanced down at her. Her lips were curved in a refined smile. "I fear I'm being a poor host, but yes, that would be wonderful," I said. I was dying for some hot tea, but getting up and going to the kitchen to boil water was beyond me. I was exhausted. It had been ages since I'd gotten so tired painting. It felt good, though. Shoko returned to the living room 10 minutes later with 3 cups and a pot on a tray. We sat there quietly, each drinking our black tea. Maria hadn't uttered a word since we left the studio. Every so often, she'd reach up to push the hair back from her forehead. She had put her heavy jacket on again, as if she needed it to protect her from something. The three of us sat there politely sipping our tea, not one of us slurped, and enjoying the lazy flow of the Sunday afternoon. No one spoke. The silence was easy and unforced, as if in accordance with the laws of nature. At a certain point, I heard a familiar sound, like waves on a distant shore, a listless and reluctant, yet somehow obligatory, lapping. Soon, however, the sound took on the unmistakable rhythm of a well-tuned engine. An 8-cylinder 4.2-liter engine with power to spare, burning, most elegantly, of course, high-octane fossil fuel. I got up from my chair, went to the window, and watched the approach of the silver car through a crack in the curtain. Manshiki was wearing a lime green cardigan over a cream-colored shirt. His pants were gray wool. They were clean and wrinkle-free, as if just back from the cleaners. None of his clothes appeared to be new. They all looked comfortably worn. That made them seem even cleaner. His hair, as always, was a glowing white. It seemed impervious to the seasons and the weather. I guessed that in summer or in winter, on sunny or cloudy days, its radiance would never fade. Only its tone would vary. Manshiki got out of the car, closed the door, and looked up at the cloudy sky. He thought about the weather for a moment, at least that's how it looked to me, composed himself, and walked slowly to the front door. Then he rang the doorbell. Slowly and deliberately, like a poet selecting the precise word for a crucial passage. However you looked at it, though, it was just a common old doorbell. I opened the door and showed Manshiki into the living room. Smiling, he greeted the two women. Shoko rose to welcome him. Maria remained on the sofa, twirling her hair. She barely glanced his way. At my bidding, we all sat down. "Would you like some tea?" I asked Manshiki. "Please don't bother," he replied, shaking his head several times and waving his hand in refusal. "How is your work going?" he asked me. "Moving along as usual," I replied. "Modeling is tiring, isn't it?" Manshiki asked Maria. I couldn't remember him addressing her while looking her in the eye before. His tone was still a bit tense, but today at least, he wasn't paling or blushing in her presence. His face looked almost normal. He was doing a good job controlling his emotions. I bet he'd been training hard to pull that off. Maria didn't answer. She seemed to mumble something, but it was entirely inaudible. Her hands were clasped tightly on her knees. "You know, she really looks forward to coming here Sunday mornings," Shoko remarked, breaking the silence. "Modeling is hard work," I said, doing my humble best to back her up. "Maria is doing a great job."
"I served as a model here for a while," Manshiki said. "I found it odd somehow. There were times it felt like my soul was being stolen from me." He laughed.
"It's not like that at all," Maria said, in what was little more than a whisper. The three of us turned in her direction. Shoko looked as though she had popped something she shouldn't have into her mouth and bitten down on it. Manshiki's face registered unadulterated curiosity. I remained, as ever, the impartial observer.
"What do you mean?" asked Manshiki.
"Nothing's being stolen from me," Maria said in a monotone. "I'm giving something, and I'm getting something in return."
"You're absolutely right," Manshiki said quietly. He seemed impressed. "I was being too simplistic. There has to be an exchange. Artistic creation can never be a one-way street."
Maria was silent, her eyes fixed on the teapot on the table. She looked like a lone night heron motionless on the shore, glaring at the water's surface for hours on end. The teapot was simple white ceramic, the kind you can find anywhere. It was old, Tomohiko Amada had used it, and eminently practical, but apart from a small chip on the rim, nothing about it warranted close examination. Maria just needed something to stare at right then. The room fell silent, like a blank white billboard. "Artistic creation," I thought to myself. Those words had a pull to them that drew all the silence in the vicinity into a single spot, like air filling a vacuum. No, more like a vacuum sucking up all the air.
"If you're coming to my house," Manshiki said gingerly, facing Shoko, "then perhaps we should go in my car. I'll bring you back here afterward. The back seat is a bit cramped, but the drive is so full of twists and turns, you'll find this much easier."
"Of course," Shoko said at once. "We'll ride in your car." Maria's eyes were still on the white teapot.
She seemed deep in thought. Of course, I had no idea what was on her mind or in her heart. I had no idea what the three of them would do for lunch either. But Manshiki was smart. He had it all planned. There was no need for me to sweat the details. Shoko sat in the passenger seat while Maria settled in the back. Adults in front, kids in back. The natural way of the world, no prior consultation necessary. I watched from my front door as the car slipped down the slope and out of sight. I went back into the house, took the teacups and teapot into the kitchen, and washed them. When I finished, I placed Richard Strauss's Rosenkavalier on the turntable, stretched out on the sofa, and listened. Der Rosenkavalier had become my fallback when I had nothing else to do, a habit implanted in me by Manshiki. The music was somehow addictive, as he had warned, an uninterrupted stream of emotion, musical instruments in colorful profusion. It was Strauss who boasted, "I can describe anything in music, even a common broom." Maybe he didn't say broom. It could have been something else. At any rate, there was something painterly about his music, though what I was aiming for in my painting was very different. When I opened my eyes a while later, there was the Commendatore. He was sitting in the leather easy chair across from me, wearing the same Oscar period clothing, his sword still on his hip. Perched on the chair, his 2-foot frame looked quite demure. "It's been a while," I said. My voice sounded strained and forced, as if coming from somewhere else. "How have you been?" "As I have told my friends in the past, time is a concept foreign to ideas," he said in a small but clear voice. "A while thus lies outside my understanding." "It's a customary phrase. Please don't let it bother you." "I cannot fathom customary either." "Fair enough. Where there is no time, there can be no custom." I stood up and walked to the stereo, lifted the needle, and returned the record to its sleeve. "As you may have surmised," the Commendatore said, reading my mind, "in a realm where time flows freely in both directions, such things as customs cannot exist." "Don't ideas require an energy source of some kind?" I asked him. The question had been puzzling me for some time. "It is a thorny question," the Commendatore answered, frowning dramatically. "All beings require energy to be brought into this world and to survive. It is a principle that holds true throughout the universe." "So what you're saying is, ideas have to have a source of energy too, right? In accordance with the universal principle." "Affirmative. It is an undisputed fact. Universal law binds us one and all. There can be no exceptions. Ideas are felicitous insofar as we possess no form of our own. We materialize when others become aware of us. Only then do we take shape. Though that shape is but a borrowed thing for the sake of convenience. So then ideas can't exist unless people are cognizant of them." The Commendatore closed one eye and pointed his right index finger in the air. "And what principle can be deduced from that, my friends?" It took a long moment to wrap my head around that one. The Commendatore waited patiently. "This is what I think," I said at last. "Ideas take their energy from the perceptions of others." "Affirmative," the Commendatore said cheerfully. He nodded several times. "You have a good head on your shoulders. Ideas cannot exist outside the perceptions of others. Those perceptions are our sole source of energy." "So then, if I think the Commendatore doesn't exist, you cease to exist, right?" "Negative. In theory, you have a point," the Commendatore said, "but only in theory. In reality, that is quite unrealistic. One is hard put to will oneself to cease thinking about a given matter. namely, to determine to stop thinking about something is itself a thought. As long as one follows that path, that something continues to exist. In the end, to stop thinking about something means to stop thinking about stopping thinking. In other words, I said, it's impossible for people to escape ideas unless they lose either their memory or their interest in ideas.
Truly, dolphins have that power, the commendatore said.
Dolphins?
Dolphins have the power to put the right or left half of their brain to sleep. Did my friends not know that?
No, I didn't.
Affirmative! It is why dolphins have so little time for ideas. It is why they stopped evolving, too. We ideas tried our hardest, but I am sad to say that all of our efforts led nowhere. It was such a promising species, too. Proportionate to their size, they had the biggest brains of all the mammals until humankind reached its full development.
So then you managed to establish a rewarding relationship with humans?
It is a known fact that, unlike the dolphin brain, the brain of the human species runs along a single track. Hence, an idea that enters such a brain cannot be easily brushed aside. That allows us to draw energy therein, and thus sustain ourselves.
Like parasites, I said.
Nonsense! Said the commendatore, wagging his finger like a schoolmaster, scolding his wards. When I say drawing energy, I mean the tiniest amount. A shred so infinitesimal the members of my friend's species are unaware. Too small to affect health or hinder lives in any way.
But you told me that ideas possess nothing like morality. Ideas are an entirely neutral concept, neither good nor bad. It all depends on how humans use them. In which case, ideas can have a beneficial effect in some cases, and a negative effect in others. Isn't that so?
E equals mc squared is neutral in itself, yet that idea led to the creation of the atomic bomb. Then the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in reality. Is that what you were trying to say, my friends?
I nodded.
My heart bleeds for you, figuratively, of course. We ideas have no bodies and hence no hearts. But then again, my friends, all is caveat emptor in this universe.
What?
The Latin for buyer beware. To wit, a vendor is not responsible for how the buyer uses his wares. Can a shopkeeper determine what manner of man will wear the suit hanging in his window?
That argument sounds pretty fishy to me.
E equals mc squared gave birth to the atomic bomb, but by the same token, it spawned a host of good things as well.
Like what, for instance?
The commendatore thought about this for a moment. He seemed to be having trouble coming up with a good example, however, for he said nothing, just vigorously rubbed his face with the palms of his hands. Then again, perhaps he simply saw no point in pursuing the discussion any further.
By the way, I asked, suddenly remembering, do you have any inkling where the bell in the studio disappeared to?
Bell? The commendatore asked, looking up. What bell?
The old bell you were ringing at the bottom of the pit. I put it on the shelf in the studio, but when I looked the other day, it was gone.
The commendatore shook his head in an emphatic no.
Oh, that bell.
Negative. I have not laid hands on it recently.
So who do you think might have taken it?
How should I know?
Whoever it was has started ringing it somewhere.
It has nothing to do with me. I have no use for it anymore. The bell was never mine alone. It belongs to the place, to be shared by everyone. So if it has disappeared, there must be a reason. No need to worry, it will show up sooner or later. Just wait.
The bell belongs to the place? I said. You mean it belongs to the pit?
By the way, he said, not answering my question,
If my friends are waiting for Shoko and Maria's return, it will not happen soon. At least not until nightfall.
And do you think Manshiki has something up his sleeve? I asked my final question.
Affirmative! Manshiki has an ulterior motive for everything. Never wastes a move, that fellow. It is the only way he knows. Using both sides of his brain all the time, he could never be a dolphin.
The commendatore's form faded little by little, and then, like mist on a windless midwinter morning, it thinned and spread until it was completely gone. All that sat facing me now was an old empty armchair. His absence was so absolute, so profound, I had trouble believing that until a moment earlier he had been there at all. Perhaps I had been sitting across from empty space, nothing more. Perhaps I had only been talking to myself.
As the commendatore had predicted, Manshiki's silver jaguar took a long time to show up. The two beautiful ladies seemed in no rush to leave his home. I stepped onto my terrace and looked across the valley at the white house, but I could spot no one. To kill time, I went inside and started preparing dinner. I made soup stock, parboiled the vegetables, and froze what I would not be using. I kept myself busy doing whatever I could think of, but when I finished, I still had time on my hands. I returned to the living room, put Richard Strauss's Rosenkavalier back on the turntable, stretched out on the sofa, and read a book. Shoko was charmed by Manshiki, that much was certain. She looked at him differently than she looked at me. Her eyes shone. He was a most attractive middle-aged man, to say the least, a handsome and wealthy bachelor, well-dressed and well-mannered, a man who lived in the mountains in a huge mansion with four English automobiles stored in its garage. It was no mystery why so many women in this world might find him charming, to the same degree they might find me less than desirable. Yet it was equally certain that Maria had a deep distrust of Manshiki. She was a girl of keen instincts. Perhaps she had intuitively divined that he was concealing the reasons for his behavior. Thus, she maintained a careful distance. At least, that was how it appeared to me. What was going to happen? I was naturally curious, yet at the same time, I had vague misgivings. My curiosity and those misgivings were therefore in direct opposition, like an incoming tide meeting the outgoing current at the mouth of a river. It was shortly after 5:30 when Manshiki's jaguar made its way back up the slope. As the commendatore had predicted, it was already dark outside.
Chapter 39. A camouflaged container designed for a specific purpose. The jaguar eased to a stop in front of my house, and Manshiki emerged. He walked around the car to open the door for Maria and Shoko Akikawa, lowering the passenger seat so that Maria could climb out of the back. The girl and the woman got into the blue Prius. Shoko rolled down the window and politely thanked Manshiki. Maria, of course, turned the other way. Then the two drove home without stopping by to say hello. Manshiki watched them until they were out of sight, took a moment to, I assumed, recalibrate his mind and adjust his expression, and walked to my front door.
"I know it's late, but do you mind if I drop in for a few minutes?" he asked rather shyly.
"Sure, please do. I'm not busy right now," I said, showing him in. We went to the living room. He sat on the sofa while I sat in the easy chair that the commendatore had just vacated. I thought I could feel the commendatore's shrill voice still reverberating in the air.
"Thank you so much for today," Manshiki said to me. "I owe you a lot."
"No thanks were necessary," I said. "I really hadn't done anything."
"But if it hadn't been for your portrait, indeed, if it hadn't been for you, period, this chance would have passed me by. I would never have met Maria face to face, never come this close to her. Everything has hinged on you. You're like the base of a folding fan. I'm concerned that you may not be enjoying that role, however.
Nothing could make me happier than helping you out like this, I said. But I must confess, it's hard to figure out how much is accidental and how much is planned. That part of it does bother me.
Manshiki thought for a moment.
You may not believe this, he said, nodding. But I didn't plan any of this. Maybe it's not all pure coincidence, but almost everything has unfolded quite naturally.
So I'm the catalyst that happened to set those events in motion? Has that been my role? I inquired.
Catalyst? Yes, maybe you could say that.
To tell the truth, though, I feel more like a Trojan horse.
Manshiki looked up at me, as if squinting into a bright light.
What do you mean?
You know, the hollow wooden horse the Greeks built. They hid their warriors inside and presented it as a gift to the clueless Trojans, who dragged it inside their fortress. A camouflaged container, designed for a specific purpose.
Manshiki took a moment to respond.
In other words, he said, choosing his words carefully, you think I may have exploited you, used you as a kind of Trojan horse? To get close to Maria?
At the risk of offending you, I do feel a little that way.
Manshiki narrowed his eyes, and the corners of his mouth curled in the beginnings of a smile.
I guess that can't be helped. But as I just said, this has been a series of unexpected coincidences. To be honest, I like you. My affection for you is personal and very natural. I don't find myself liking many people, so when it does happen, I try to take it seriously. I would never exploit you for my sole convenience. I know I can be selfish, but I'd like to think that I'm able to draw a line between friendship and self-interest. You're not being used as a Trojan horse. Not now, not ever. So please, don't worry.
He didn't seem to be making this up. His words had the ring of truth.
So did you have a chance to show them the painting? I asked. My portrait of you in your study?
Of course. That's why they came in the first place. They loved it. Though Maria didn't say anything. She's a girl of few words, as you know. But I could tell how strongly she felt. It showed in her face. She stood in front of the portrait for a very long time. Just stood there, not speaking or moving.
In fact, I couldn't remember the portrait very well, though I had finished it only a few weeks before. That was my pattern. The moment I launched into a new painting, the one I had just finished, slipped from my mind. Only a vague and general image remained. I did retain a physical memory, however, of the sense of achievement I got from working on it. That palpable sensation meant more to me than the completed work.
Their visit sure lasted a long time, I said.
Manshiki gave an embarrassed shrug.
After they'd seen your painting, I gave them a light lunch and showed them around. A tour of my house and the grounds. Shoko seemed interested, you see. The time flew by.
I bet they were impressed.
Shoko was, I think, Manshiki said, especially by my Jaguar XKE. But Maria didn't say anything. Maybe she didn't like my house, or maybe she's not interested in houses in general.
I guessed she probably couldn't care less. Did you have a chance to talk to her? I asked.
Manshiki shook his head no.
She opened her mouth two or three times at most, and what she said was almost meaningless. She generally ignores me.
I kept quiet. I had no special thoughts on the matter, but I could picture the scene. Whenever he tried to start a conversation with Maria, she would clam up, just mumble a word or two. Once Maria made up her mind not to speak, trying to reach her was like ladling water onto a parched desert.
Manshiki picked up an ornament from the table, a glossy ceramic snail, and inspected it from a variety of angles. The snail had been one of the very few decorative objects left in the house, probably a piece of Dresden china, the size of a smallish egg, purchased long ago, perhaps, by Tomohiko Amada himself. Manshiki gingerly returned the snail to the table. Then he raised his head and looked across at me.
"I guess it will take her a while to get used to me," he said, as if addressing himself. "I mean, we've only just met. She's a quiet child to begin with, and 13 is said to be a difficult age, the beginning of puberty. All the same, being with her in the same room, breathing the same air, it was a precious experience. Priceless, really."
"So then your feeling hasn't changed?" Manshiki's eyes narrowed slightly.
"What feeling do you mean?"
"That you don't care to know if Maria is your child."
"No, that hasn't changed a bit," Manshiki said without hesitation.
He chewed his lip for a moment before continuing.
"It's hard to explain, but when she's near and I look at her face and watch her move, this odd feeling comes over me. The sense that somehow my life up to now may have been wasted, that I no longer understand the purpose of my existence, the reason I'm here, as if values I'd thought were certain are turning out to be not so certain after all."
"And for you, these sorts of feelings are extremely odd, am I right?"
"For me, they were par for the course."
"That's right. I've never experienced them before." "And they started after spending several hours with Maria?"
"Yes. You must think I'm some kind of idiot."
I shook my head no. "Not at all. I felt the same way when I hit puberty and met a girl I liked."
Manshiki gave a small smile. There was something rueful in it. "That's when the pointlessness of all my accomplishments and successes and all the money I've accumulated hit me. That I'm no more than an expedient and transitory vehicle meant to pass a set of genes on to someone else. What other function do I serve? Beyond that, I'm just a clod of earth."
"A clod of earth," I tried saying the words. They had a strange ring.
"To tell the truth, I was down in the pit when that realization hit me. Remember that pit we uncovered behind the shrine, underneath the pile of rocks?
How could I forget?"
"If you'd felt like it, you could have abandoned me there. Without food and water, my body would have shriveled and returned to the soil. I would have been no more than a clod of earth in the end."
I didn't know what to say, so I remained silent.
"It's enough for me," Manshiki said, "that the possibility exists that Maria and I are related by blood. I feel no compulsion to find out if it's true or not. That mere possibility has sent a beam of light into my life. Now I can look at myself in a new way."
"I think I understand," I said. "Maybe not every step in your reasoning, but the way you feel. What I don't get is what you're expecting from Maria, in concrete terms."
"It's not that I haven't given that question any thought," Manshiki said.
He looked down at his hands. They were beautiful hands with long fingers.
"People devote a lot of energy to thinking about things, whether they want to or not. Yet in the end, we all just have to wait. Only time can tell how events play out. The answers lie ahead."
I remained quiet. I had no clear idea what he had in mind and no compelling desire to find out. Were I to know, my position might become even more difficult.
"I've heard Maria is much more forthcoming with you," Manshiki said after a long pause. "That's what Shoko said, at least."
"That's probably true," I said cautiously. We seem to be able to talk quite naturally when we're in the studio. Of course, I didn't tell him that Maria had come to visit me from the adjoining mountain through a hidden passageway. That was our secret.
Do you think it's because she's gotten comfortable with you? Or because she feels some personal connection?
The girl is fascinated by painting, maybe artistic expression in general, I explained. If a painting is involved, there are occasions, not always, mind you, when she's quite comfortable talking. She's not a typical child, that's for sure. When I taught her at the community center, she didn't speak much to the other kids.
So she doesn't get along with children her own age?
Maybe. Her aunt says she doesn't make many friends at school.
Menshiki pondered that for a moment. She opens up with Shoko to some extent, I guess, he said.
So it seems. From what I've heard, she's much closer to her aunt than she is to her father.
Menshiki merely nodded.
His silence seemed charged with implication.
What sort of man is her father? I asked him. Have you checked?
Menshiki looked to the side and narrowed his eyes. He was 15 years older than she was, he finally said. By she, I mean his late wife. Of course, late wife meant Menshiki's former lover. I don't know how they got together or why they married. I have no interest in those things, he said. Whatever the case, though, it's clear he loved his wife dearly. Her death was a terrible shock. They say he was a changed man after that.
According to Menshiki, the Akikawas were a big landowning family in the area, much as Tomohiko Amada's family was in Kyushu. Although they had lost nearly half of their property in the land reform that followed World War II, they retained many assets, enough that the family could get along comfortably on the income they produced. Yoshinobu Akikawa, Maria's father, was the first of two children and the only son, so when his father passed away at an early age, he became the head of the family. He built a house for himself at the top of the mountain they owned and set up an office in one of their buildings in Odawara. From that office, he managed the family properties in the city and its environs, several commercial and apartment buildings, and a number of rental houses and lots. He also dabbled in real estate. In other words, while he kept the business going, he made no attempt to broaden its scale. The core of his enterprise consisted of looking after the family's assets when the need arose. Yoshinobu married late in life. He was in his mid-40s when he tied the knot, and his daughter, Maria, was born the following year. Then, 6 years later, his wife was stung to death. It was early spring, and she had been walking alone through a big plum grove they owned when she was attacked by a swarm of large hornets. Her death hit him hard. To wipe away anything that could remind him of the tragedy, as soon as the funeral was over, he hired men to raise the plum trees and yank their roots from the earth. What was left was a dreary and barren plot of land. It had been a beautiful grove, so its destruction was painful for many. Moreover, for generations, those living nearby had been permitted to pick a portion of the abundant fruit to make pickled plums and plum wine. As a result, Yoshinobu Akikawa's barbaric act of retaliation deprived many local residents of one of the small pleasures they could look forward to each year. Still, it was his mountain. The plum grove was his, and no one could fail to understand his fury at the hornets and the trees. As a consequence, those complaints were never voiced in public. Yoshinobu Akikawa turned into a rather morose man after his wife's death. He hadn't been particularly social or gregarious to begin with, and now his introverted side only grew stronger. His interest in spiritual things deepened, and he became involved with a religious sect whose name was unknown to me. It is said that at one point he spent some time in India. At great personal expense, he built a grand hall for the sect's use on the outskirts of town, where he began spending much of his time. It's not clear exactly what takes place there, but it appears that a daily regimen of stringent religious austerities and the study of reincarnation helped him find a new purpose in life after his wife's death. These activities reduced his involvement in the business, but his duties hadn't been all that demanding in the first place. There were 3 long-time employees more than capable of managing things when the boss failed to show up. His visits home became more infrequent. When he did return, it was usually just to sleep. His relationship with his only daughter had, for some reason, grown more distant after his wife's death. Perhaps she reminded him of his dead wife. Or perhaps he had never really cared for children. In any case, as a result, the child never really took to her father. The responsibility for looking after Maria went to his younger sister, Shoko. She had taken leave from her job as secretary for the president of a medical college in Tokyo and moved to the house atop the mountain near Odawara on what she expected to be a temporary break to look after the child. In the end, though, the arrangement became permanent. Perhaps she came to love the girl, or perhaps she couldn't stand idly by when her little niece needed her so much. Having reached that point in his account, Menshiki stopped to touch his fingers to his lips. "Do you happen to have any whiskey in the house?" he asked. "There's about a half a bottle of single malt," I said. "I don't want to impose, but could I have some?" "On the rocks." "My pleasure. But aren't you driving?" "I'll call a cab," he said. "No point in losing my license." I went to the kitchen and came back with a whiskey bottle, a ceramic bowl of ice, and 2 glasses. In the meantime, Menshiki put the record of Der Rosenkavalier that I had been listening to on the turntable. We sat back and listened to the lush strains of Richard Strauss as we sipped our whiskey. "Are you a devotee of single malt?" Menshiki asked. "No, this was a gift. A friend brought it. Sure tastes good, though." "I have a bottle of rare scotch at home that a friend in Scotland sent to me. A single malt from the island of Islay. It's from a cask sealed by the Prince of Wales himself on his visit to the distillery there. I'll bring it on my next visit." "You needn't make such a fuss on my account," I said. "There's a small island near Islay called Jura," he said. "Have you heard of it?" "No," I replied. "It's practically uninhabited. More deer than people. Lots of other wildlife, too. Rabbits, pheasants, seals, and 1 very old distillery. There's a spring of fresh water nearby, just perfect for making whiskey. If you mix the single malt with that water, the flavor is absolutely amazing. You can't find it anywhere else." "It sounds delicious," I said. "Jura is also known as the place where George Orwell wrote 1984. Orwell rented a small house on the northern end of the island, really the middle of nowhere, but the winter took a terrible toll on his body. It was a primitive place with none of the modern amenities. I guess he needed that kind of Spartan environment to write. I spent a week on that island myself, huddled next to the fireplace each night, drinking that marvelous whiskey." "Why did you spend a whole week in such an out-of-the-way place all by yourself?"
"Business," Menshiki said simply. He smiled.
Apparently, he wasn't going to let me in on what sort of business was involved, and I had no particular desire to find out.
"I really needed a drink today," he said, "to settle myself down. That's why I'm imposing on you like this. I'll come and pick up my car tomorrow, if that's all right with you."
"Of course, I don't mind at all."
We sat there a while without talking.
"Do you mind if I ask something personal?" Menshiki broke the silence. "I hope you won't take offense."
"Don't worry, I'm not a guy who gets offended. I'll answer you if I can."
"You've been married, correct?"
I nodded. "Yes, I was married. As a matter of fact, I just mailed off the divorce papers, signed and sealed. So I'm not sure if I'm officially married now or not. Still, it's safe to say that I was married for 6 years.
Menshiki was studying the ice cubes in his glass as if deep in thought.
Sorry to pry, he said, but do you have any regrets about the way your marriage ended?
I took another sip of whiskey.
How does one say buyer beware in Latin? I asked.
Caveat emptor, Menshiki said without hesitation.
I have a hard time remembering how to say it, but I know what it means.
Menshiki laughed.
Sure, I have regrets, I replied, but even if I could go back and rectify one of my mistakes, I doubt it would change the outcome.
Do you think there's something in you that's impervious to change? Something that became a stumbling block in your marriage?
Perhaps it's my lack of something impervious to change that was the stumbling block.
But you have the desire to paint. That must be closely connected to your appetite for life.
There may be something I have to get past first before I can really get started with my painting, though. That's my feeling, anyway.
We all have ordeals we must face, Menshiki said. It's through them that we find a new direction in our lives. The more grueling the ordeal, the more it can help us down the road.
As long as it doesn't grind us into the ground.
Menshiki smiled. He had finished his questions about my divorce. I brought a jar of olives in from the kitchen to accompany our drinks. We nibbled on them while sipping our whiskey. When the record finished, Menshiki flipped it over. Georg Scholte continued conducting the Vienna Philharmonic.
Menshiki has an ulterior motive for everything. Never wastes a move, that fellow. It is the only way he knows.
If the commendatore was correct, what move was Menshiki making, or about to make, now? I hadn't a clue. Perhaps he was holding back for the moment, waiting for his opportunity. He said that he had no intention of exploiting me. Probably he was speaking the truth. Yet intentions were, in the end, just intentions. He was a savvy guy who had managed to survive and thrive in the most cutting-edge sector of the business world. If he was harboring an ulterior motive, even if it was dormant now, it would be next to impossible for me to avoid getting sucked in.
You're 36 years old, right? Menshiki said out of the blue.
Yes, that's correct.
That's the best age.
I didn't see it that way at all, but I didn't say so.
I'm 54. Too old to be fighting on the front lines in the business I was in, but still a little too young to be considered a legend. That's why you see me dawdling around like this.
Some become legends in their youth, though.
Sure, there are a few, but there's no great merit in that. In fact, it could be a real nightmare. Once you're considered a legend, you can only trace the pattern of your rise for the rest of your life. I can't think of anything more boring than that.
Don't you ever get bored?
Menshiki smiled.
I can't remember ever being bored. I've been too busy.
I could only shake my head in admiration.
How about you? He asked. Have you ever been bored?
Of course, it happens a lot. In my case, however, boredom is an indispensable part of life.
Don't you find it painful?
I guess I've gotten used to it, so it doesn't feel like pain.
I bet that's because painting is so central to your existence. That's your core. Your passion to create is born out of what you call boredom. Without that core, I'm sure you'd find boredom unendurable.
So, you're not working these days, are you?
That's right. I'm basically retired. I do a little computer trading on the stock markets, as I've told you, but that's not out of necessity. It's more like a game, a form of mental discipline.
And you live in that big house all by yourself?
Correct.
And you still never get bored? Manshiki shook his head. I have so many things to occupy my mind. Books I should read, music I should listen to, data to gather, sort, and analyze. I'm used to staying active. It's